Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show. It is our annual rundown of the underrated, the overrated, and the ugly. So as always, I am joined for this very special year-end show by JB.
What a great year for movies. What a great year to go. That song is copywritten, so don't.
Yes. No, don't be putting that in front of the Oscars.
No other use given or implied.
The MTV Movie Awards, the Blockbuster Awards.
What a great year. But like most years, I don't think it started well. And by the middle of the year, it was looking shaky. And then, of course, anything decent comes out in the last half, and it's shaping up to be a good year.
And I had a very good year of movie watching, but I feel like most of the good movies I saw this year were not 2017 movies. I just watched a lot of older movies that I liked a lot.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because now that I've turned 55, the AARP, I didn't realize this before, they require me
yes.
to go to one classic matinee a week, or I lose my apprentice status. I'm an apprentice, retired
a Padawan
person,
if you will.
A Padawan retiree.
That explains your little braid.
I wish a full quarter, 25% of the movies I saw this year were classics, but in a theater.
Right.
Between TCM Fathom Events and the Chicago Critics screenings at the Elk Grove, it was a really good year for, it's better to see it in a real movie theater with a ginormous screen.
And that's heartening, because I'm always a little bit frustrated that in Chicago we don't have much of a repertory scene. I'm so jealous of New York and Los Angeles, because they can go see old movies all the time. And
in Chicago, the repertory scene is the music box.
Right, basically.
We've got both kinds, the music and the box. But I used to say this endlessly when AMC, the AMC theater by our house that we both frequent, that when it opened, it had 30 screens. And this is back when I'm teaching film study. And I would scream to anyone who would listen, could you devote one of those 30 screens? Well, they remodeled and got the seats that no one likes. I'm now convinced that no one likes those new seats, because I've actually heard in these repertory screenings, older people loudly decry the seats.
Wow.
I've heard this at several screenings. In fact, two old ladies were talking about how they love Deer Park, because Deer Park has the old seats. Hold on, where was I going?
Hate the seats, 30 screens, got rid of them, remodeled.
They remodeled the theater, and now it's 24 screens.
Yeah.
Like some sort of Egyptian pyramid. There's a whole part of the theater that's walled off.
Yeah.
And in a couple of years, I'd love to see what that's like. It's like you go in there with a flashlight with the Spielberg beam. People used to come here. They were happy here. And there's actually people in the seats, and they're like frozen with the face on that where they were watching the movie.
This is where people saw Rush Hour 2.
They remember being happy here. Not at Rush Hour 2. It's,
no. Well, yeah. listen.
Yeah. Rush Hour 2, it's better than Shanghai Noon.
That's right. That's true. Or Shanghai Nights. It's, we've been doing this show since our first year, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is like the seventh or eighth time we've done this. It's weird because, again, in years past, my underrated list, which is what we're going to start with, has often included movies where I felt like, hey, this got bad reviews, or but John Carter, you know, being a famous example,
yeah.
Like, hey, how come people didn't like this more? And I had a much harder time finding those movies this year, and so I ended up with a lot of really small movies that just not enough people saw. I didn't feel like there were big movies that got a bad rap.
And I was afraid, just like what you just said, that the underrated list is now becoming small independent films
mm-hmm.
that have no chance of getting the kind of release that a mainstream film does. And that's the reason in our mind that they're underrated, because fewer people see them
right.
and talk about them.
Right.
And there's less of a buzz. And all of these underrated films, you can tell they're independent films, I think, because they still have interesting rough edges We've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. And that a big studio release has to jump through so many hoops and satisfy so many things that it sort of becomes homogenous in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So if anything, this year my underrated list, like you said, are a lot of quirky little films that
right.
still have the things in them that make us, again, in your words, not make toast in the bathtub.
I don't remember saying that.
That's an oldie but a goodie. And early, in early F This Movie columns, Patrick had a tendency to come up with very colorful ways of all alluding to the same thing. That's my second favorite.
Okay.
Making toast in the tub. In
okay.
fact, I think in my classroom that sort of became a meme. Making toast in the tub. But I think my all-time favorite is, I would cry, but it would rust the gun in my mouth.
Oh,
there were a whole bunch of other ones, too.
Oh, I'm washed up.
I don't know if any of you do this who listen to the podcast machine, but if you go back and read old columns, it's really interesting. We were very different people
really?
6 years ago.
Interesting.
And I would argue very different writers.
Okay.
I know I can only speak for myself.
Sure.
When I started, even for all my English teacher bona fides and all that nonsense, when I started, I didn't know what I was doing. Those really early
columns. I
don't
agree with that.
It's like, oh, it's like I'm demonstrating what all my high school and college teachers used to say. There's no development. Talk about this more. Why can't you go into some detail? Nope. These are the insights. These are the jokes. These are the jokes, folks.
These are the insights needs to be the name of your next column.
These are the insights. Ellipses. Take them or leave them. One thing, though, and I think I've talked about this before, either in print form or on the podcast, the more you write, the better you get. So when you hear famous writers say over and over, if you want to be a writer, you need to write. You need to establish a schedule, and you need to write on a consistent basis. It's hard for me to imagine someone doing it over and over and not getting better
mm-hmm.
in whatever sense you want to define getting better. But I think I've become a better writer. I'd like to think I do.
I don't think I've gotten better. I think I've gotten faster.
I would also argue, because, and this is not just patting you on the back, you've always been an excellent writer, but it's changed.
Okay.
The character and tone of the prose has changed.
In what way?
Let me think about
it. All right. This is interesting.
I think it's more thoughtful now.
Okay.
I think it's more in depth. I think it's less jokey.
Sure. It's probably less jokey.
I think we've all become less jokey.
Yeah. Are we just out of jokes? Is that what it is? Or is there just nothing to laugh about anymore?
You know, that's interesting.
2017, nothing to laugh about.
It's interesting you hit on that because the new 2018 motto of AARP, I don't know if I told you this, we're all out of jokes. Oh, it's just such a crazy serendipity here at F This Movie.
What is
we're all out of jokes.
What is your first underrated film?
Well, I'll tell you. I resisted going to see The Foreigner.
Okay.
Because I would argue it had one of the worst trailers of the year. The trailer makes it look like some 70s drive-in movie. Or some sort of remake of Taken.
Right.
And Jackie Chan is out for revenge. He's going to kick everyone's ass. Well, it's not that at all.
Okay.
I think they were afraid of what they honestly had on their hands and engineered a trailer that made it look like an action film. It's not. It's based on a novel, this very intricate sort of British counterintelligence. The whole Jackie Chan thing is only one piece of the puzzle. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on with the Irish Republican Army and terrorists in the streets and all this other stuff. And it's really good.
Cool.
I don't think it's great.
Okay.
But it's one of the few times this year that I went and felt I got three times more
all right.
than what I was expecting. Pierce Brosnan is in it and is really good. I saw him on some talk show. He's Irish. And at the beginning of his career, worked to get the Irish
right.
out of his accent.
Right. He always plays English, it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in The Foreigner, he's allowed to actually, he said he actually had to work on it because, right? But his Irish accent is astounding.
Wow.
And it's really, really good. Kind of a rainy day movie from On Demand or Redbox or
something. It looked like a Redbox special. It looked like it's Rob DiCristino movie.
Exactly. It's really good.
All
and
right.
Not what they were selling.
I will check it out for sure. That's good to hear. My first pick is a movie that I may have written about before on the site. It's called American Fable, which showed at the Chicago Critics Festival last year and didn't get released until this year, written and directed by Anne Hamilton. It's about a small farming family who capture a man in their silo, basically, and kind of what happens from there. And the young daughter, who's played by Peyton Kennedy in a really, really, really good child performance, kind of befriends the man. It's just, it's a really cool movie. I think it's streaming on Netflix. It's just one of those that I want to bring people's attention to.
Is it anything like The Woman?
No, it is not.
Okay.
It is not a horror film.
Because as you describe it,
yeah,
I'm
right.
Like,
no.
That sounds a little
no,
bit like,
no.
Okay.
It is not a horror film. But
on
it
the
has.
And there's very little that is like
that's
The Woman.
True.
So
it has a little bit of a. Even though it's not a horror film, I feel like it does have a little bit of a Stephen King vibe. It reads like one of his non-horror short stories, and there's some fantasy elements in it. But yeah, I think it's really worth checking out. And like I said, I believe it's streaming on Netflix. So there's almost no commitment.
My next underrated film, and I think it's getting a little. Awards buzz, but it perhaps will be overshadowed by The Shape of Water. It's Maudie.
I did not see Maudie. This is Ethan Hawke and Sally Hawkins?
Right.
Okay.
And it is Maudie, right? It's not Maud.
No, I believe it's Maudie.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is Maudie, and I went and had no idea. I have an empty afternoon, and this is something I've never seen, and it's terrific in a very down, low-key way, rather. And I gave it so much credit because it so easily could have been a Hallmark movie,
right?
About this woman who no one gave any credit to, and she was, I don't want to say abused, but she was very badly treated by her family, especially her brother, and everyone thought there was something wrong with her. So she picks up and gets a job, and she gets a job with Ethan Hawke. She's going to clean his house and cook for him. And he's this sort of village handyman who's got 10 different jobs. And they slowly forge this relationship. It's very, very unconventional. But spoiler alert, she likes to paint.
He's a fishman. Oh, sorry.
No, that's the other. That's the real Oscar bait.
Right. Oh, look what you did. Benicio del Toro's The Shape of Water.
She loves to paint. And she starts decorating their house and then somehow comes into some money so she's able to afford canvases. And her style is very distinctive. And she starts selling paintings outside the house and gets the attention of an art critic. And again, spoiler alert, but this is probably on the DVD case. She becomes New Zealand's most famous artist. She becomes this incredible folk artist. And at every turn, they resisted the made-for-TV cliche. Ethan Hawke plays a character who's not nice, and the film is not interested in prettying that up or giving him some sort of redemption. It was astonishing, and obviously, I think both of us are fans of Sally Hawkins.
Yeah, of course.
And it's really nice to see her get parts that are different than other things
sure.
that she's
yeah.
played.
Yeah.
And if you can't get a chance, you should see Maudie. It's really, really good.
All right. Was she the sister in Blue Jasmine?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay. Did you ever see Happy Go Lucky, the Mike Lee movie?
No.
It's really good.
And she's in that.
She's the lead, and it's her performance is amazing. I think that's where she first got on my radar, was in that movie. But she's great. Yeah. All right. Maudie. We got to check it out. This is fun. I like when we haven't seen each other's movies because then I have more stuff to watch. My next pick is a film that I think maybe played some festivals and then more or less debuted on Netflix. It's a movie called Teenage Cocktail. And it is about two young women, Nicole Bloom and Fabienne Therese, who's one of these actors who's very active in indie horror, and every time she shows up in something, I think, oh, cool, there's Fabienne Therese, because I'm always happy to see her. And they are just kind of bored in their suburban lives, and they begin to, solicit men online, but not for sex necessarily. It's just sort of they're just talking to men online.
I think I saw the trailer for this.
One of the men is Pat Healy, who again is always great to see in stuff. And, that goes to some interesting places. And I just thought it's a really, really good movie about sort of, you know, it kind of reminded me a little bit of, Smooth Talk for this generation, you know, involving sort of the internet and social media.
And if you've never seen Smooth Talk,
oh my gosh,
love Laura Dern.
That movie's amazing.
That, for a lot of different reasons. A year or two ago, I had a conversation with Pat Healy at Flashback, and he's really nice.
Yeah.
And we had this wonderful conversation about cheap
thrills.
Yes, because I was very taken with that movie.
Well, of course.
And I think I'm still taken with that movie. My next underrated film, I think you saw.
Okay.
And this is one of those films where you see it, and it was better than I expected.
Okay.
I wasn't expecting much, because perhaps I had just seen Mike and his brother need wedding dates, or whatever that horrible, horrible thing is called. Ingrid Goes West.
Ah, yes.
Which I'm not saying it's a great movie, but it had a lot more in it than I was expecting.
I liked it a lot.
That it was willing to follow, have the courage of its original premise.
Yes.
To present really unappealing characters and not try to tart them up. I'm thinking of the Olsen character's brother.
Yes.
Is just the most horrible person ever.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because in terms of the narrative, something happens later on where it's clear they're willing to forgive him this awfulness,
right.
But a specific awful thing that he did prevents them from being as awful as they'd like to be. I'm really dancing around this movie. Aubrey Plaza is the star, and it says a lot about internet culture and what we want and things like that. And it was very disturbing. And I'm trying to remember. Was I applauding the ending or thinking the ending was... Oh, no. I was applauding the ending.
Okay.
Because just when you think it was going to go to this sort of artificially happy ending to wrap it up, there's that final curve where what has transpired will make her worse.
Okay. I think I remember.
That we think this horrible thing has taught her lesson.
Right.
But this horrible thing is going to lead to her...
Right. I think I remember.
And again, I don't mean to talk circles around it, but it was a real little rainbow in a period of the year where the movies coming out weren't very good.
Yeah. I thought it was a movie about, like you said, sort of the modern internet age that was very smart about it. And I'm not one for it's primarily like an Instagram thing, and I don't really spend any time on Instagram or whatever, but I could tell that it got that stuff right.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do. You know, you see movies all the time that are trying to like, hey, let's talk about this thing, but they get it so wrong because it's a screenwriter's idea of what this thing is, or a filmmaker's out of touch idea of what this thing is.
Because there are actually people who are paid to sort of post things that are actually advertisements for consumer products.
Right.
That their Twitter feed or their Instagram or their Snapchat is actually sort of this curated online catalog.
Right.
And that's how some of them earn their living.
And Elizabeth Olsen, I think, is playing a very specific type of person that truly exists. I think the MVP of that movie is O'Shea Jackson Jr.
Yes, and Adam had pointed this out, and I thought he exists not so much to be us, but he's the center of the film, reminding us what normal is.
Right.
Because everyone else in the film is damaged in one way or another.
Right. I had seen him in Straight Outta Compton and thought, boy, he reminds me a lot of his dad. But I wasn't sure if we were ever going to see him do much outside of that. And
the
this,
Ingrid Goes West performance is very different.
So different. Yeah. And is like, oh, no, he's a real actor who is incredibly likable and who I want to see in more stuff.
Yeah.
His whole Batman fetish is amazing.
And it really underlined, it really, I'm using that word wrong, that it served to underline, it served to underline that because we like him so much, when the Aubrey Plaza character abuses their friendship, that really, because there's a danger that because Aubrey Plaza is the star, we're going to think everything that she does is cute or funny.
Right.
And he's there to remind us, oh, no, no, no. If someone did that to you, that's just really shitty.
Yeah. Yeah. It is out on DVD and Blu-ray and VOD now, so you guys can check it out. It's good. And I think a really smart, you know, Aubrey Plaza is one of these actors who's pretty typecast. It's like we need her to be this one specific thing. But then you sometimes get, I'm thinking of like Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love, where somebody says, ah, but here's what we do with that thing that he does. And that's sort of this, I think, for Aubrey Plaza, where it's like, she does this one very specific thing. Ooh, but what if we tweaked it so that it became this instead? And that's way more interesting.
True. And if I could just skip to my next one, because there's a segue.
Yeah.
I like the projects she chooses.
Okay.
Because she also appeared in The Little Hours.
Which I did not see.
And I gotta say, comedy is hard. And as we hurtle forward, I think studio big budget comedies will never be funny again. Because I think to most big movie studios, a comedy is a movie where people act crazy or awful, or there's all these awful, horrible things. Because if you do the type of things in a comedy that I think qualifies your film to be a comedy, that it's clever and there's a point of view and you have to be intelligent to get it. And so we have these comedies that seem to be designed for the least common denominator, where it's poo-poo and I'm vomiting somewhere and stuff like that. No joke that you risk if you're going to do something intelligent that's funny, that people won't get the joke. The Little Hours is based on Boccaccio, who wrote all of these bawdy stories, you know, hundreds of years ago. And I don't want to say that the film was sold improperly, but I went to see it like having seen a clip on a talk show, and comedy is subjective, but it's hilarious. It's probably one of the three funniest films that I've seen this year. There are three nuns who are cloistered, and it's a very, very long time ago, and they're awful. They're awful. In fact, that's the clip that I saw. They're out picking some crop or something. The convent does all this work, and they sew clothes and stuff. And this workman from the town comes by, and these three nuns just start swearing at him and berating him and calling him awful names. And that was enough to get me to go see it. All of their awfulness is explained. Alison Brie is in it, along with her husband, Dave Franco. I think Dave Franco directed it.
No.
No?
No.
Okay, my bad. And
I forget the name of the director, but it wasn't Dave Franco.
John C. Reilly's in it. Molly Shannon's in it. Kate Micucci is the funniest thing in the entire film. And Fred Armisen, is he ever not great? Has this amazing cameo as the Monsignor who comes in to, I don't want to give it away. It made me laugh more than any film this year. There might be two films where arguably I laughed more.
Are they ones that are going to come up? Because I want to ask what they are.
Okay. But yeah, I don't want to play that game. It's hard to make me laugh.
Okay.
The Little Hours made me laugh a lot. The Big Sick made me laugh.
Sure.
But I give that credit for actually being a story and that they had a lot of other boxes to check, not just being funny.
Right.
I honestly think the film that made me laugh the most this year was The Disaster Artist.
Okay.
I agree with Rob and Adam's column where the film can be faulted for not being as ambitious as perhaps we wish it was. But there's something about Franco's Wissou impression.
Yeah.
And just what they choose to include. It didn't hurt that I saw it at the Music Box.
Right.
The first weekend it was open, so we have the They Came Together
syndrome. Right, right, right.
Where you're seeing it with the perfect audience for that film, and they all want to laugh to show that they're supporting the film. But in general, I think it was a really shitty year for comedy.
Yeah, it's even as you're describing the cast of The Little Hours, which I haven't seen and absolutely will. Last week or the week before, I watched The House, the Amy Poehler, Will Ferrell, Let's Open a Casino.
I skipped it.
It's not good, but it does the thing that so many comedies do now, which is there's about 20 people that show up in all of these movies.
Yeah.
And they're all people that I like, and so I'm happy to see that. I mean, everybody you named in Little Hours.
Catherine Hahn does a lot of those.
Right, right. Rob Hubel and Jason Mantzoukas, and, you know, there's a bunch of people where I'm like, hey, you have some goodwill because I like you. And so when every actor that shows up in your movie is somebody that I have some affection for, I can't have the worst time. But it does seem like more and more comedies are just thinking, well, hey, if we get enough of these people together, surely something funny will happen,
funny
right?
People make a funny movie. But just what you're saying about The House makes me think that the other rules for big budget studio comedy is it has to be high concept. You have
right,
to be able to describe
right.
it. Two ordinary parents open a casino in their house. What could possibly go wrong?
Right.
And I think every big-budget Hollywood comedy of the year you could summarize in one sentence. It's far more difficult to summarize Ingrid Goes West or The Little Hours in one sentence.
Sure.
I would even say it's hard to describe The Big Sick in one sentence.
Yeah, definitely.
In fact, describing The Big Sick in one sentence does not make it sound like a comedy.
That's what's special about that movie.
Right, one of the things that it's going for.
All right, so my next pick is a movie called Get the Girl, which is directed by Eric England, friend of the show. And I'm not just picking it because he's been on the show a couple of times and has always been a great guy. It's just a movie that kind of came and went. It was it barely got theatrical distribution. It showed up on VOD. It's one of these new Orion titles, and it's great to see the Orion logo show up, but they don't know how to get a movie out.
Where did we see that first?
Like the new Orion?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's the old logo, but I don't know what the first movie was.
Is the new Orion the release of Victor Crowley?
I don't think so.
I was at a screening.
Yeah.
And it must have been something fanish.
Okay.
Because when that Orion logo came up, people were like, what?
Yeah, right.
People
exactly.
were aware
right,
that
right.
they weren't just seeing a corporate logo.
Yeah. So Get the Girl is fun. It has a real 90s vibe on purpose. And it's essentially, you know, it's hashtag problematic when you actually examine what the movie is about, which is, you know, a guy hires someone to kidnap the girl that he likes so that he can be the hero and rescue her. And obviously it gets more complicated.
What could possibly be
right, exactly. So it gets more complicated like that. With that. But the cast is good. It's funny. It goes to some interesting places. And I just think it's a really confidently made movie. And so of course I'm always rooting for someone who I like each time they make a movie to see them grow. And I think genre fans would enjoy it. It's been showing up on cable.
And this is great because you only see movies at 3 a.m. in your basement. I am tethered to local movie plexes.
Right.
And the big screen. So I am, and I've said this in previous years, I'm making a list now
yeah.
of stuff that when my wife and I are like, you want to watch something on demand? Oh, got the list.
Nice.
Got the
well,
list.
Well, that would make me happy.
Got the list right here. My next underrated film. Oh, the thing about movie company logos. When I first went to see The Woman in Black and the Hammer logo.
Oh, sure.
It's like we did a podcast on a James Bond film. I believe it was
Skyfall.
Yes. When they open the garage and we all see what's in the garage. I think that's the closest I've ever been to one of these Star Wars super fans when the garage door opens in Skyfall.
Right. But then they made Spectre, and I'm looking at the new Orion movies, but it's not showing up.
I seem to remember. You know what? I might be misremembering, and this reaction I'm talking about was just in my brain.
It's possible. Belko? Did you see Belko experiment in a theater?
That's what it was.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Okay.
Because as a child of the movie theater, I've seen that original Orion.
Sure.
I mean, they put out a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Way back when.
Yeah.
My next underrated film, and another wonderful surprise, although I shouldn't have been surprised, is Brigsby Bear.
Yes.
The Kyle Mooney film.
Uh-huh.
And I am beginning to think that he's one of the only reasons to watch SNL anymore, because what they're doing is becoming so sort of programmed and automatic, and, you know, and maybe after 40 years it's inevitable. Every week you can tell what sketch is him, and not just because he's in it.
Right.
A lot of them are little movies and stuff. I went expecting sort of a precious independent film, but Brigsby Bear is a lot more ambitious than that.
Yeah.
And while it's not a complete success, I think it says things about people and entertainment and things that we cling to. I thought Mark Hamill was amazing.
Yeah.
Not only as the bad dad, but also as a bunch of voices
right.
of these crazy characters. I'm so tired of going to studio films and being disappointed. It's wonderful to go to these other things and have thoughts and laugh in unexpected ways. And his character in that is sort of pathetic, but in a very touching, endearing way.
Well, yeah, that's sort of the neat thing about that movie, which could have been Little Miss Sunshine and isn't.
Yeah.
What I really liked about the movie was it's not, hey, look at this weirdo, let's have everyone be freaked out and laugh at him. Instead, everyone likes him. Everyone warms to him very quickly and is interested in Brigsby Bear as he talks about
it. And is trying. The scenes where he first is reunited with his real family, I gave the film so much credit. There's just so much awkwardness mm-hmm. in that. And not movie awkwardness. You like pie?
Right, right.
But like what might actually happen
right.
when someone is reintegrated? Well worth people's time.
Yeah.
And a really nice surprise.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. Next for me. Oh, well, since we just brought up Belko, I will bring up Mayhem, the new movie from Joe Lynch, which is on VOD now and I think coming out on Blu-ray right after Christmas, because why would you put it out before Christmas when somebody might buy it for me?
Someone was complaining on the site a week or two ago that the studio that released it made a real big mistake not releasing it before Christmas on different platforms.
Why do that?
Yeah, I don't know what.
And I know the new model is digital 2 or 3 weeks early, so that maybe you get everybody to buy it twice, you know, or because Blu-ray is less and less important to the studio. So I don't know. You could buy it digitally now, but not on Blu-ray.
Now, I read your review of Mayhem.
Yes.
And would you say Mayhem is a better film than Belko Experiment?
Yes.
Because you thought it went into office politics and it was more realistic about that?
No, I wouldn't say realistic. That's not the word I would use. But it was
more in depth.
I think so. I was a little bit frustrated with Belko, which I liked enough. But I thought it almost could have taken place anywhere. It wasn't really about office culture or certain power structures.
That's true. Well, lip service.
Right. I mean, Tony Goldwyn is the boss, but it doesn't go much further.
No.
And this movie is a lot more about sort of office culture and that frustration with kind of selling your soul. And it's structured a little bit like a video game in that the boss is on the top floor. We got to get to the top floor, and so we have to kind of fight our way up there.
So it's a remake of The Raid.
Not exactly, because it's a lot more comedic. Steven Yeun is really, really great. You know, The Walking Dead, I guess, is done with him. And
I saw a horrible joke on Twitter last week. What's Steven Yeun's favorite takeout food?
What?
Popeyes.
Oh, God. Yeah, horrible. That was really... Anyway.
That's when I stopped watching The Walking Dead.
I think
Sorry.
You made the right call.
I'm out.
I think you made the right call. Samara Weaving is amazing, and I just think it's really, really fun and entertaining. And again, like I said with Eric Englund, I'm a Joe Lynch fan, and it's fun to see him get better with every movie. So that's a movie I want people to check out.
Which I'm now writing.
Woohoo!
On the list.
Yeah.
But it's very violent.
Not like... crazy violent. Belko is more violent.
Okay.
Yeah.
The poster.
Yeah, no. The violence is, if there is a lot, if there is violence, it's way more stylized.
Okay.
Yeah.
My next underrated film, I talked about it on the podcast before. I'm hoping it gets released, if only on a flash drive that's thrown into the ocean.
Yeah.
And one day you find a bottle when you're walking along the beach. It's called The McGrumpies.
Yeah.
I saw it at the Nashville Film Festival. The more I think about it, the more distance I put between myself and the film. And it's not just because my son and I enjoyed a delightful drink with the author of the film. We were talking earlier about big bucks studio comedies. The McGrumpies is so loose and lumpy and true and unexpected and has all these weird, it really understands what a farce is and how you put that in motion and when you have to spring the trap and when the reveal has to happen and that there's a reveal within the reveal. And I talked about this on a previous podcast, but it's called The McGrumpies. It's a comedy about immigration, about the sort of awful xenophobic feelings that some people have about recent immigrants. And it's so funny and so delightful, and I think 10 people are going to see it total. So one of these platforms that just buys everything.
Right.
I heard a figure of how much Netflix spent this year on original programming. I believe it was $6
billion. That doesn't surprise me.
They premiered a new television show, you know, where they drop
right.
all the evidence.
Right.
They drop all the evidence. They drop all the episodes every week of the year.
That's
Netflix. It's called The McGrumpies. Yeah. It's a hard sell. It's in several languages and it's subtitled, but this thing's got to get a release.
Does a cop team up with like an orc cop in it? Because Netflix is willing to shell out $100 million for that.
Is that thing that I saw?
Right.
And I thought it was a remake of Alien Nation.
Yeah, I mean, it basically is, but it's not. I mean,
even Joel Edgerton looks like
right.
Mandy Patinkin.
Right.
And
right.
Do they like spoiled milk? That was the big joke.
Yeah, I remember that. I haven't watched Bright, and I'm not in a hurry to watch Bright.
And James Caan, in every frame of Alien Nation, if you could read minds, James Caan is thinking, I can't believe my career has sunk so low. I was in The Godfather.
Yeah.
I was in The Godfather.
I was in Thief.
I was in Rollerball.
Yeah, he was. Do you think that your enjoyment of The McGrumpies, while still a good movie, do you think any of it has to do with sitting down and watching something that you literally knew not one thing about except a title?
Yes, but, and we've talked about this,
yeah.
Knowing something versus not knowing something.
Yeah.
In fact, if memory serves, what was in the program at the film festival was completely
okay.
The description was not even close to what the film was. I'm beginning to think it's better to know nothing.
It is.
But years ago, we talked about this Halloween marathon.
Oh, yes.
Where you're not told in advance.
Right, right.
And you said there's no way that
yeah.
you could sit down and... But maybe with age,
yeah,
and
maybe.
Maturity.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just that you want to know the title. I want to know that before I go, I want to know what it's called. That's all I want to know. I don't want to know anything else. But part of it might be these are actors from all over the world, and I don't think anyone from America. And so there's no preconceived notion
right, right.
of what you've seen them in
right.
before, what they usually do, and you can more readily accept them as the characters, which in this case makes sense because it does kind of take the form of this documentary that this news station is making about recent immigrants. It's so funny.
and so well observed. And just when you think, okay, I got this, there's three more surprises.
I just, the more kind of festivals that I go to, you know, I don't watch trailers for any of the movies that I'm seeing. I often won't even read the plot synopsis. I just sit down like, okay, let's see what this is. And not knowing exactly where something is going has been very rewarding. And even something like Brigsby Bear, which I just watched a few weeks ago, I knew Kyle Mooney was in it. I knew it was about a children's show, maybe. That's literally all I knew. So,
and like I said before, that's how I sat down with The Little Hours and probably Maudie. And in the case of The Foreigner, I was misinformed. I saw this trailer, which completely
right
undersells the film.
Yeah, I'm moving away from marketing a little bit. Speaking of which, I sat down to watch a movie at the Cinepocalypse Festival in early November. This was the opening night film. Arguably, it was the wrong film to open that particular festival. But it is a movie called Sweet Virginia, directed by Jamie Dagg. And it stars John Bernthal, who's great in everything, and we're just always happy to see him.
He was just on Stern. It was a really interesting
movie. He's a huge fan, yeah. So I remember that from his Walking Dead days. He's a former rodeo star who now runs this little motel, and some people are...
So it's a prequel to the Florida Project.
Some people are killed because a hitman comes to town, played by Christopher Abbott, who was in It Comes at Night earlier this year. Mm-hmm. He's the younger guy. His performance alone, I think, in Sweet Virginia makes the movie worth seeing. But, I mean, the cast in general is really great because you have Rosemarie DeWitt, who's never bad in anything.
Yeah, she's great.
John Bernthal, always great. Imogen Poots shows up. It's, you know, it's a quiet movie. Has kind of it, a little bit of like a noir western vibe. But just, I think... well worth the 90 minutes, you know, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, just kind of a character piece. Really well done in a movie that I wish more people had talked about. Again, I feel like it was the wrong movie to open that festival because it's so different than everything else they showed, and it's not really a horror film, and it's not even really an action film. It kind of has more of like a 90s, that period, like around Fargo when there was a lot of sort of crime, yeah, noir, you know, southern stuff. Red Rock West comes to mind. Those kinds of movies.
Yeah.
But it's on VOD, and my guess is it'll be on Netflix within a month or two, because I believe it's an IFC Midnight title, and I think all of their stuff goes to Netflix. So when it shows up, look for it. I'm sure I'll recommend it on in a Friday column, but people should see it. I think it's good.
Speaking of the Friday column.
Yes.
At some point in 2018, can I do the iStream Ustream? Could there be like a guest?
Sure.
Programmer?
Sure.
I have some ideas.
Okay.
So now I have all these suggestions from you of underrated films that are good. Mm-hmm. So I will stay in my family room. I will watch Match Game reruns in the afternoon. And then I will watch these films on VOD.
All right.
Very quickly, I think I caught this on VOD because it was not released. It escaped. My son was talking it up. Good Time?
Yes.
Did you wind up seeing it?
I did.
And what did you think?
I will admit that I didn't respond to it the way that a lot of people have. It's gotten a lot of good press. Yeah. I thought it was okay. I thought it was more impressive as a calling card for those two filmmakers.
Sure.
Than it was a successful movie. I thought Robert Pattinson was good. It was a movie where I wasn't exactly sure where it was going to go because it doesn't really give you any indication of...
Right. And given the film genre, I think that's saying a lot.
Yeah,
because
sure.
We've seen a lot of those movies.
Right.
And I was impressed by the performances and the surprise.
Yeah.
Just how grim it is.
Sure.
In a way that a lot of films aren't grim. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's Hollywood grim, and then there's this is about a bunch of sad lives. So Good Time was really impressive to me because now I have this thing called the Robert Pattinson test, where having seen one of the worst performances in any film in Water for Elephants, when Pattinson shows up and either gives a good performance or, God forbid, I'm not even sure it's him for a little while. He successfully tricks me into giving the benefit of the doubt. He's certainly playing a very different character in Good Time than any other film that he has been in. And also, I think that's why I was so initially impressed with Lost City of Z, which you finally saw.
Yes.
And
I thought it was okay. I wanted to like it more than I did. And what I had written on Twitter, which is how this came up right before we started recording, was that I could not get past the performance of Charlie Hunnam at the center of the film.
And let's be more specific. What was it about the performance that you could not get past?
I thought it was bad.
Okay.
I think he's a bad actor who keeps getting big parts in big movies. And I don't get it. He's very handsome. I understand that.
And I think part of the problem there was I haven't seen him in as much other stuff as you have.
You saw Pacific Rim, right?
He's in Pacific Rim.
He's the lead in Pacific Rim.
Oh, my God.
He's the doctor in Crimson Peak.
Oh, wow.
And you didn't see King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which will come up shortly.
Okay, then he's clearly... I respond to Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak quite a bit. So he's this invisible actor who I'm clearly ignoring because I don't remember. I really like the theme of Lost City of Z, that all of these white guys have enough hubris to say we're going to go conquer the world.
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen. I also liked its scope because so many movies are very...
Sure.
They're in a couple rooms in a house.
Sure.
And it's this... grand historical epic.
And this is not fair, but for much of the film...
And it passed the Robert Pattinson test.
It did.
Because he's good in it.
He's great. And it's been nice to see... I was going to bring this up when you were talking about Good Time. It's been nice to see him turn in these two really good performances, Kristen Stewart and Personal Shopper. Like, mm-hmm. look at what interesting work these actors are doing now that they're free of the shackles of Twilight.
Well, the ultimate example of that is Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing,
mm-hmm.
where it's all of these people you've seen in every bad TV show and every bad low-budget movie, and suddenly they're doing Shakespeare, and it's like, oh,
right.
They're actors.
Right. So maybe it's not the actor. That's the problem. Lost City of Z, this is not fair, but I spent two-thirds of the movie just wishing I could watch the Werner Herzog version of that movie.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. It's a Herzog film.
Pretty much.
Some of this stuff with them, like going back to England, Herzog wouldn't bother with. He would just put them out in the Amazon and leave them there. And he essentially did make that movie several times. So I was watching it just thinking, like, I should really rewatch Aguirre because that's one of the best movies ever made.
I remember my lovely wife, who apparently is now more popular on the podcast than
She's
I.
She's more popular than all of us. Don't worry.
Had a big problem with the ending because clearly, I don't know if this is spoilers for Lost City of Z or not. We pretty much know how the story ends, and the film instead gives us something that you could arguably interpret in very many ways, or at worst, it's the most romantic, beautiful version
of
what happened. And she had a problem with that because one of the themes of the film is sort of anti-colonialism and anti-imperialist and, oh, you think you're... No. And then suddenly we get something lush and really hopelessly romantic at the end, which seems to undercut the message.
I thought the colonial stuff was interesting. I thought all the times he would go back to England, I was less interested in the stuff with him and his son, and maybe that's just personal taste. It is streaming on Amazon Prime for those of you who are... interested in checking it out.
Do you think it's worth our listeners 2 hours?
Yeah, I think so.
Because I saw lots of stuff this year that was worse than that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I don't think it's a bad movie. It just, I, you know, wanted to love it and didn't. But I think I have yet to really love a James Gray movie.
Right.
But I'm glad that he exists, and I'm glad he's making movies, and I'm glad he's making movies like this, because not many people are anymore.
This also might be part of the syndrome we're talking about, where I knew less than nothing about it when I went. It was... Well,
and it's very old-fashioned.
We haven't seen... And
they could have made that movie in 1974.
And clearly, I'm becoming the old guy who likes old-fashioned, because that's one of the reasons why I like Murder on the Orient Express so much. That movie... could have been made in 1962.
Yeah, that movie's going to come up again, right? Not this week, maybe next week. I'm not trying to tease anything. I'm just waiting to say the thing that I want to say about that movie.
Did you see it?
I did. Because you had loved it so much. I found myself very frustrated. It's not the story and the performances. I thought all that stuff was good. I found myself very frustrated by the number of shots of the train and the landscape in motion, mm-hmm. clearly all done by computers.
Yeah.
And I just cannot for the life of me figure out, why am I looking at this? It's not telling me a story. It's not adding anything to the movie. And it's not even, hey, look what we filmed. Which is the only other excuse that you could have. Look at this train. Look at this location.
But if the filmmakers believe that it's photorealistic and will fool people, which I would maintain it does not.
No.
Because it looks very CGI.
Yes.
I don't think I've told this story before on the podcast. If I did, maybe before.
We've been doing it for a long time.
2049.
Okay.
Let me know. The week after it came out, I saw it the weekend it came out. The week after it came out, I was at a theater for a Fathom event, and it was the afternoon, and it was a sea of white heads, and they were all there to see Murder on the Orient
sure.
Express. I was like, oh, my people. And this is the audience for that film. But I was interested in how it did opening weekend because, as we've discussed, older people, it takes them a couple weeks to.
Sure,
oh,
yeah.
Flory said this was good.
Flory?
You know.
Oh, Flory. Got
Flory. It. Flory. You know, Tutty's half sister. These are all names of distant family members. You know, Tutty. Pinky's brother. I swear to God, there were two brothers, Pinky and Tutty.
Oh, my gosh.
And Pinky had red hair.
Yeah.
I don't know why Tutty was called Tutty, but it was Pinky and Tutty. And Pinky and Tutty, one of them was the father of my attorney when I've needed a lawyer.
Okay.
Because when you're Italian, you're not allowed to hire anyone outside the family. So I was interested in how Murder on the Orient Express did. Does this sound familiar? Did I talk about this before Blade Runner?
I don't think so.
Maybe. You know what? I think I was just having a conversation with Adam Risky, and I was telling him about this. Box Office Mojo gives you the results of the weekend. It also, when they have it, tells you the budget. Here's something I couldn't believe. Murder on the Orient Express was made for very little money.
Okay.
An astonishingly small amount of money when you consider. I think it was Woody Allen syndrome, where everyone wanted to work with
sure.
Branagh, and they
sure.
agreed to work for less. And you could say, because it has a sweep, because it has a lot of stars in it, because it's old-fashioned, you could argue the money's on the screen. Maybe the filmmakers felt they could make a movie that looks more expensive
okay.
if they fill it with all this stuff, where if they actually shot it, it would be expensive.
Right, right.
Murder on the Orient Express cost substantially less than Daddy's Home 2.
That doesn't surprise me.
But it did surprise me. I stood there with my mouth open. Daddy's Home 2 is four people in a house.
But those four people were all expensive.
Right. But Murder on the Orient Express has 12 people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're
who are better
bigger,
actors,
better people. Right, better right, 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 right.
So
and Johnny Depp.
I'm just thinking it was an attempt. If you're going to say this is very old-fashioned mm-hmm. and it has a scope and a sweep, that was their attempt to give it a
sure.
scope and
sure.
a sweep. On a budget, and it's been reported they are going to make.
I heard that. Yeah,
because that's teased at the end.
Which I'll go see.
I will admit that the pace is slow.
No, I didn't. I didn't have a problem with the pace, honestly.
Because in our screening, people fell asleep.
Okay.
The people sitting next to us fell asleep.
Okay. I might have started to at one point, but not because the movie bored me. It just happened.
So you liked it. You didn't love it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was right up my alley.
That's great. That's a good feeling when that happens. It
my next
happens
underrated
so early.
Film is Colossal, which came out, and we loved it, and then you heard nothing
yeah.
at all ever again,
yeah.
except Mondo put out a little maquette of the creature.
Nice.
I think the special edition sold out. I don't know if it's memorable or cute or horrible enough to really want that in your office, but it's big and heavy and expensive.
Sure.
why does this happen? Colossal has stars in it, and it's full of ideas, and it certainly is targeted at a certain, or is it, it's not quite a comedy, and it's not quite a horror film, and it's going to disappoint Godzilla freaks, and it's...
Yeah, I think that movie's audience did see that movie. I just don't think that audience is as big as we think.
Because I'm not misrepresenting it. Both of us loved it.
Yes. But I think the stars that you're talking about, you know, people aren't going to see Anne Hathaway in that movie. They're going to see her in The Devil Wears Prada.
Right.
And people that flocked to see Godzilla aren't going to see that movie because it's not Godzilla. And even though so many blockbusters these days appear to be made for nerdy fanboys, I think Colossal is much more for like the nerdy fanboys who live in Austin and not who live across the country. You know, I think
semi-hipster nerdy fanboys.
Yeah, it's just it's a smaller audience than we think because superhero movies come out and make hundreds of millions of dollars, but that's because everybody goes to see those now. But Colossal's terrific.
We're going to call them schumpf bugs. Schumpf bugs. Semi-nerdy fanboys.
It's
semi-hipster nerdy fanboys.
It's streaming on Hulu. If you guys haven't seen it yet, you absolutely should.
I did the free trial for Hulu.
Yeah.
2 years ago.
You still have Hulu.
To see the Beatles. Oh, that's the marketing strategy. I've talked about this. Yeah. It's the heroin marketing strategy. The first dose is always free. I wanted to see that Beatles documentary for free. It has cost me hundreds of dollars.
You should watch that Dana Carvey documentary, though. I think you would
did.
Like. Oh, okay.
You had recommended Ustream, and I think I watched it a couple weeks ago, and I was amazed.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be this shitty hour-long thing because they were going to start streaming the Dana Carvey show.
Right.
But oh my God.
No, it's good.
The people they got and the points that they make.
It's good.
And the thing that you pointed out, that one of them has an epiphany when they slowly realize, no, we're on after that Tim Allen sitcom, and this week it's a very special episode
I'll spoil the moment, but it's literally like a commercial for Home Improvement, a show I've never seen, but it's a very serious commercial where Jonathan Taylor Thomas is like, I don't want to die. And the narrator says, a very special Home Improvement, followed by the Dana Carvey show. And it cuts to Colbert laughing so hard he can't talk for 30 full seconds. It is, and it's like, oh, this is why we failed. It's amazing.
And you should also see every episode of the Dana Carvey show.
Including the one that never aired.
Wrong time slot.
Yeah.
Perhaps the wrong network. But
100% the wrong network.
Waiters who are disgusted by food.
Right.
In fact,
skinheads from Maine.
In the documentary, Colbert said that's what got him the gig on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Because The Daily Show staff were big fans of waiters who are disgusted by food.
Right. I like that documentary. But that kind of sketch comedy is never going to work on broadcast TV. Even SNL can't do that.
Are you too young to remember The News Show?
Yes.
When Lorne Michaels was out in the wilderness after he stepped down from Saturday Night Live.
This is like the Gene Demanian years?
Well, right. And Lorne Michaels did this thing that was on Friday nights at 8 or 9 called The News Show. And it was going to be sort of sophisticated and sharp and funny. But basically it was SNL.
Right.
That's all he can do.
Right.
And my wife, who was then not my wife, we used to watch it in her dorm after happy hour on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just odd. It was odd. But the reason why I bring it up is because it's another piece of evidence that proves your point. What you can do after 10 o'clock doesn't sell before 10 o'clock.
Again, Mr. Show is so great because they were on HBO and nobody cared. They just let them do what they want.
And HBO was famous for showing it at like,
right,
you really better be committed to watch this because...
There was an interesting revelation. We're off topic here, but there was an interesting revelation that I think gets to a philosophical difference that maybe you and I share when it comes to comedy. When they were talking about waiters who are disgusted by food, was it Smigel who said you have to call it waiters who are disgusted by food? I can't remember. or maybe it was something that Lorne Michaels had told him when he was doing Saturday Night Live. Somebody said, why are you hiding your joke? Tell people what your joke is. So call it waiters who are disgusted by food, so that when they start having that reaction, we understand why it's funny. And I'm back and forth on that, because part of me hates SNL's need to contextualize everything. Part of me would think it was just funnier if the sketch played without being told what it was called, but I don't know.
Well, that's interesting, because the Andy Kaufman biopic, Man in the Moon, which I'm of two minds about, and you recently watched a documentary.
No, I'm not watching that documentary. Other people keep watching it and talking about it, and every week it's me saying, I'm not going to watch that, because I get douche chills thinking about it.
It shows up a lot on cable.
And Man on the Moon does.
I catch little pieces of it. Yeah. And I like to catch the beginning of it, because that's when Andy Kaufman was doing all those amazing things. And the last half hour is the cancer part. It's no good. By the way, people who comment on the podcast say they like when we get off topic.
Oh, all right, good.
So, Patrick,
how you sleeping?
Sexual harassment is bad. It's very bad.
It
and
is.
I'm against it.
Me too.
Andy Kaufman, that... He had this famous thing where he went on Fridays, which was a pathetic Saturday Night Live clone on ABC, and he appeared in the sketch, and people are still sketchy about whether he went off script deliberately, and he wouldn't read the lines, and Michael Richards threw water at him or the cue cards, and it was a melee, and then they went to commercial. In the movie, they recreate that sketch. And I went on YouTube because I wanted to see the sketch on Friday.
Okay.
I wanted to see the actual sketch to see how well they had redone it. And obviously this was a long time ago, but it actually begins with a woman addressing the camera and saying, "We take you now to a restaurant where three couples have met for dinner. What all of them don't know is that every time someone gets up to go to the bathroom, they're smoking marijuana in the bathroom."
Oh, my gosh.
And then they go to the sketch. Because they had no assurance
right.
that when the stone person came back, people... I mean, talk about...
Oof. That's like a high school variety show.
And the funniest thing in the sketch is when the Andy character comes back from the bathroom... He does nothing, and then he starts muttering,
right.
I can't play stoned. I can't. I just can't do this. Another underrated film.
Yeah.
And my final one.
Okay.
That got a lot of attention, and I was of two minds, and I was on the fence. And I don't like being on the fence, because I'm a sizable man, and it's hard to sit on the fence. Is the film Mother, with a small M.
Yeah.
In an exclamation point. And we had discussed off... Mike, that we would both like it better if it didn't have those biblical parallels.
Right.
If it was just the weirdest thing you've ever seen.
Yes.
And if it didn't have those one-to-one straight biblical parallels, you could say, okay, I see what this is about. It would sort of become the Kafka novel that he never wrote.
Right.
That you're enjoying a nice night home with your husband, and then all hell breaks loose.
Again, when people describe nightmares or, oh, this movie's like a nightmare, those aren't my nightmares.
No.
This feels like a nightmare because it's a situation that you sort of recognize.
That palpable something's going on and you're not being...
You're out of the loop, right.
Right.
And it's this feeling of like, and it keeps going and it keeps building too. So there's people just keep showing up and you don't know why and they won't leave your house alone and they won't get off the sink when you ask them to get off the sink. and they won't. All that stuff is amazing.
And what finally cemented how I honestly think about Mother is the fact that I am not a fan of Mr. Aronofsky in any way, shape, or form. But Mother was unlike anything I've seen in a really long time. I thought the performances were strong. I thought his command of the narrative and the way in which it spins out into craziness and the pace at which it does was astounding. So most people hated it.
Yeah.
And it became fashionable to slag on it, and it had the lowest something or other.
Well, again, it was that CinemaScore thing, but every time they publish, like, here are the movies with an F CinemaScore, you look at them and you're like, well, five of those are good. So but this means
I'm
nothing.
I'm wondering what anyone who went to see that was expecting.
Jennifer Lawrence. Maybe Rosemary's Baby. You know, because they advertised it very much like Rosemary's Baby. The poster was designed
and
to look exactly like...
For the first half hour, there's some similarities.
But Jennifer Lawrence is a giant movie star. Yeah. And so people were going to see that. And maybe it looked a little bit weird because audiences are interested in a little weird, having no clue just how weird that movie's willing to be.
The now famous John Carpenter quote, "Scare me a little. I think I like it." A little.
Right, right. That may show up on my list next week. I might need to rewatch it. But except for the biblical stuff, I think it's really, really strong. And I'm, you know, back and forth on Aronofsky because I get where you're coming from, just having little patience for his pretentiousness. And Mother, by the way, is pretty pretentious. Like, it's not less pretentious than his other movies.
If I were in charge of the studio, I would have sold Mother as a very loose remake of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
And now I can't make this joke because it's such a spoiler. I was going to talk about what Buddy Hackett was going to do. But anyway, so let's talk.
It was a mistake to hand the baby to Buddy Hackett.
There it is. I'm glad we're on the same page. Let's talk about our overrated films. And I, again, every year have to do this disclaimer about overrated. So this year, I'm instead of saying overrated, I'm going to call these disappointing. These are movies that I was excited about and then didn't like for one reason or another.
And I noticed that a lot of mine were disappointing in the same way.
Okay.
But we'll get to that.
Okay. The first one on my list is Kong Skull Island.
Which I also put on my list because no one is a bigger horror movie fan, by weight, if not by volume, than I am. And certainly I love King Kong. I even have a lot of affection for the Dino De Laurentiis thing, which is the black, when it breaks out of that cage and for 6 seconds, it's by gum that robot they built. And it matches nothing else. Dino built that robot.
When the people see my monkey, they're going to cry.
Nobody cry when the jaws die. It's the famous second part of the quote. I think my problem is because I thought the CGI stuff in Kong was good.
Sure.
And I liked the Kong stuff. We talked about this on the podcast. Excuse me. But everything else in the movie is five different movies.
Yeah.
In the words of Patrick Bromley, you can see the different color script pages.
It's far from the worst movie I saw this year. No. I just really wanted to love it. I liked the trailer. I liked the idea of sort of trying to make it a Vietnam allegory, but I didn't think that worked.
And people commented on our original podcast.
Yeah, quite a bit.
And said the same thing in different ways. It was a fun popcorn movie.
Yeah.
And I'm not against that. I would like to see a better popcorn movie, but I understand. That's, you know, I think that's the level at which I enjoyed Pacific Rim.
Right. And it goes back to, not to bring up Independence Day Resurgence, but it goes back to that where you said, I had fun. And I said, well, I can't argue with fun because you can't. And so a lot of the comments were like, yeah, I see what you guys are saying. But I still had fun. Like, great. We can't take that away from you. I'm glad you had fun.
Did I mention that I caught it again on cable?
Yeesh.
It was less fun.
Does it hold up?
It was less fun. The seams.
Were they starting to show?
Yeah. I think part of it was there's a bunch of actors in the original Independence Day that I like.
Yeah.
And here they are again.
Sure. Bill Pullman had that kick-ass beard.
Well, I'm not going to spoil Independence Day research.
Good, good.
I would not.
No, no one would forgive you.
Look, the aliens win at the end. Everyone's destroyed. And the last shot is that creepy alien thing that's actually learned to hold a straight razor in its little tentacle.
Yeah.
And he shaves the corpse of Bill Pullman.
Which was kind of a fuck you, I felt like. But
and then he makes that noise and it's subtitled there. Blackout.
What I thought was impressive, though, was that the filmmakers got us to the place where we were sympathizing with the aliens by the end of the film, so that when they won, we were like, yeah, they deserve that.
When I saw
they wanted it more.
When I saw it again on cable.
I cannot believe you watched it again.
I have seen that movie twice. That whole thing about that ball.
Okay.
Remember?
Yeah.
There's a ball. Sort of. Going to tell them something.
Oh, my God, that movie.
That seems to be a whole other screenplay they bought.
You think?
And shoehorned it into alien research.
What's on your overrated list or disappointing list?
And I don't want to spoil the party, but I noticed a trend this year, and it might not just be a trend this year, and this is why these films are overrated. We have a very serious subject matter that's being tackled by very serious, accomplished filmmakers.
Yes.
So, of course, to badmouth the film would be to give up the fact that you seemingly are devoted to good films.
Right.
Capital G, capital F, and you, in some cases, that you're sort of turning in your liberal credentials because these films are about, in fact, I just realized there's another one to add to the list.
Hold on.
So I thought all of these films were well-intentioned, but ultimately disappointing. And I would put them all in the same box.
All right.
The Paper.
That was not a movie. The Post.
Oh, and my God, the Paper is actually a Ron Howard film.
I like that movie.
And at this point, people only half listening. Why is he talking about The Paper?
We're doing a whole Ron Howard retrospective, everyone. Up next.
And I know that for most areas of the country, The Post hasn't opened yet. So just say it has the best intentions, but I feel it falls short.
I would agree with that.
I did like the fact that at least an effort, a fleeting effort was made to talk about the Meryl Streep character as a woman in a man's world.
Yes.
That was certainly something that was brought to the party. But I think I can highlight this phenomenon by talking about other films. I went to see the film Marshall.
Okay.
And Thurgood Marshall, for a number of reasons, his work on the Supreme Court, is sort of a personal hero of mine. And I thought it was odd that this biopic would choose a very early case of Marshall. Maybe that's so we can have a young, good-looking actor play a man who, in his later years, wasn't exactly a handsome movie idol. But also, this case where, because he's arguing it, I forget what state he's arguing it in, you have to get permission from the judge if you're certified as a lawyer in another state.
Okay.
If you're registered, I don't know how it works. I did not become a lawyer. If I'm a lawyer in Illinois, there was something, maybe they got rid of this, but back then, that if I'm arguing a case in Rhode Island, I have to get permission from the judge to argue the case in a different state, or I need to present the case with another lawyer who's certified, right? So they sort of picked this very specific case that Thurgood Marshall was involved in, maybe because it involved a racist judge, because then the drama's built in. But in the reality of the film, the Thurgood Marshall character is forced to argue the case with Josh Gad, who doesn't want to do it, and he's involved in another blah, 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 blah. And I thought this is a return to the story of a black man told from the eyes, that we're getting that again, which I thought we were past, because of all the cases he argued, of all the stuff he did on the Supreme Court, here's the one where we could involve a white actor so that it won't, And maybe as an acting challenge, the judge, who's just so racist he might as well be wearing a hood, says that Marshall's allowed to argue the case, but he's not allowed to speak in court. So this whole thing becomes that the Marshall character is coaching the Josh Gad character, too. And I just thought it was really dishonest, though well-intentioned.
Right.
I thought the same thing about Darkest Hour, which I was really looking forward to, and it really tells us nothing about World War II that we didn't know. It teaches us that Gary Oldham is an amazing actor, which we knew already. And as I told you before we started the podcast, it seems like they got old him and they thought they were done.
Right.
And certainly the story of how Britain wound up winning World War II is interesting. And as I told you before the podcast, an interesting triple feature would be The King's Speech, Dunkirk, and The Darkest Hour, which I'm now calling The Longest Hour, would be interesting because they all sort of dovetail. But I also thought the same about Dunkirk, that this is a big, important topic,
right,
and a big, important director, but I had problems with a lot of it,
yeah,
for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
I think there's some compelling filmmaking.
Yeah.
But
I was not really a fan of Dunkirk.
I thought the same about Detroit, which you just saw the other night.
Yeah.
And except for the extended sequence of the interrogation,
which is impressive
and hard to sit through.
Yes.
2 weeks after I saw the movie, I was like, why was that so forgettable other than
right.
the really unpleasant thing?
Yeah.
And I could not put my finger on what Detroit was missing. But I'm not alone, because that film came out
yeah.
earlier in the year. And
I think that section of the film, which is, I mean, roughly half, I would, you know, there's kind of a quarter in front of it and a quarter after it, but roughly half of the film is that section in the middle, which is amazing filmmaking and good performances and hard to watch, as you said. I wonder if they had extended it to being just that, or cut off some of the beginning and the end, and it had really just been that. I don't know how you make a whole movie out of that, but would it be a stronger movie?
But then that makes me think, is this the reason that everyone wanted to make the film?
Maybe.
And that's sort of disturbing.
Sure. But again, think about both Detroit and The Post. Think about, these are both period films that are talking about 2017.
Yes,
both
and
films.
I give them credit for yeah. that a lot, especially yeah. in terms of The Post talking about freedom of the press. And finally, in this big box, I would also place Battle of the Sexes, which is this historic film where we have these two actors who are beloved portraying these historical figures. And I appreciate the recreation of what things were like. But I thought in Battle of the Sexes, a lot of it was designed to get us to cluck our tongues quietly in our seats and say, yeah, things used to be that way.
Yeah, it's a weird movie. Like, I found it super watchable, but it almost doesn't. They don't really choose what they want to be about, so it's trying to be about a lot of things. And it, every once in a while, will remember, like, oh yeah, we have to also be about Steve Carell. And so it tries to give him an arc,
because
but it's not his
film,
story.
Right, the film forgets about him for long yeah. periods of time. And as much as I like Andrea Gainsborough...
Riseborough.
Who I've seen in a lot of things,
sure.
doing
Always
a lot
good.
Of different things.
Yeah.
It turns out her character doesn't really exist, that she's an amalgam
right.
of apparently all the women that led Billie Jean King to realize. And I
right.
thought that was something of a cheat, because one of the things I liked in the film was Billie Jean King's husband's reaction to what was going on, mm-hmm. which was either, this is the most understanding husband who ever lived, or if that's what needs to happen for this money train to continue.
Oh, I didn't think it was that at all.
Really?
No.
That he was...
Yeah. Because I think the postscript confirms that.
That he was a great guy.
That that Billie Jean King and her partner are, I think, the godparents of his children.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it's...
Yeah. I mean, that really put the whole thing into focus for me, because the whole movie, you're like, is he willfully ignorant? Is he... What is this? And then when I saw that little postscript, I was like, well, that's beautiful.
Extraordinarily broad-minded.
That's a beautiful story.
I think the filmmakers were worried. Well, first of all, the amalgam character is a lot easier to do.
Right.
I think the filmmakers were worried that showing Billie Jean King... and please don't think I have this reaction, because I don't. When I go to movies, I'm completely immoral. It's a picture show. It's not really happening. That if she was shown being a serial adulterer.
Right.
That would have made her character.
Unsympathetic.
Right. But again, like all the games Ron Howard played with the Beatles documentary.
Yeah.
This happened.
Right.
So there's a limit.
Right.
Or maybe there is no limit to what you can change.
Again, we're always saying, you know, we like movies to be about more than one thing, but sometimes when you're trying to be about too many things, you do a disservice, because on the one hand, it's this story about equality and, hey, recognize female athletes, and then on the other, it's sort of just a biopic of Billie Jean King and her awakening as a gay woman, and it's – I don't think the two things sit well together. I think either could work.
But then there's the third element, which I actually thought was entertaining. Bobby Riggs, crazy, screwed up circus, sideshow life, that just the of him coming up with games against these rich guys to that whole, that he sort of became a tennis hustler.
But so much of the things used to be like this, you know, is shown through Bobby Riggs and what he says and does. But I feel like the movie comes down on the side of, like, it's kind of a goof with him that he's playing a heel on purpose.
But having lived through what we're talking about, I think that's a gloss that the film is putting on it.
Okay.
Because that Billie Jean King, my wife remembers this too, was a really big deal that year. And the real Bobby Riggs, it didn't come off like a goof.
Because it really does. Because even in the scenes where it's just the two of them, Steve Carell kind of plays it like, haha, you know I don't mean this. It's like pro wrestling almost, you know, the way he's... And it certainly presents other evil male characters like Bill Pullman with no beard. so it's not that that's missing from the film completely, but I think it undercuts a little bit of what it's trying to say by suggesting, like, Bobby Riggs, he's just, that's just who he is. He's just goofing around, you know, I don't know. But
I want better biopics.
Yes.
Filmmakers take note by watching Ed Wood, perhaps.
Yes, perhaps.
And better historical dramas, because except for the budget, except for the budget and the stars, I thought a lot of what I saw this year was basic cable tardiness.
Right, right. But again, Darkest Hour, you know, can get an Oscar nomination for Gary Oldman, and
he deserves one.
A makeup nomination, and that will be enough to drive the box office in January and February when everybody goes out to see the movie because it's been nominated for an Oscar, and so their work is done.
There's so many different credits for the prosthetics. They're so convincing, I just thought he put on weight.
Yeah.
So clearly they figured out.
Right.
Because you know the syndrome I'm talking about.
Oh, sure.
Where it's prosthetics, and you can tell because everyone's got that slitty duck mouth.
Yeah. Well, look at those pictures of Kevin Spacey and All the Money in the World. Like, what were they doing?
And
what?
I just gave away my porn name from the 70s. I was Slitty Duck Mouth.
Any other disappointments for you? I have a handful.
Yes, and I would love to hear from the two listeners who wind up seeing this. I can't think of a documentary this year I was looking forward to more than Dawson City, Frozen in Time. I might be getting the time wrong.
How much were you looking forward to it?
Dawson City, Frozen in Time.
Frozen Time.
Frozen Time.
Dawson City, Frozen Time.
And I thought it was going to be a documentary all about them finding this cache of amazing rare films in the Yukon, which was the end of the distribution chain back in the teens, and there was no point in sending things back because by the time they got there, they were beat up, and they just sat there in the back room of a theater until they decided to put in a skating rink, and they used all these boxes of film under the skating rink to shore it up for decades and decades and decades. And because it's so cold up there, it preserved the film. So when they found this cache of film, they were finding stuff that this is the only copy. And spoiler alert, it's not London After Midnight.
Damn it!
It's a lot of stuff. And the filmmaker presents it where most of the visuals are curated clips from the film that was reclaimed with endless words on the screen that narrate it. And first of all, part of the thing is to look at the film that was reclaimed, often with nitrate damage that shows that it's authentic. What is the point of taking up real estate?
Right.
I could not understand why there wasn't a voiceover narrator unless he's trying to ape the very silent films that he's showing with titles on the screen, but I bought it on Blu-ray and it was just unfathomably esoteric and odd. And I don't want to say it was boring because I'm very interested in these things, but it was very hard to keep your attention on the screen. One cool thing is Fred Trump, not our president's father, our president's grandfather, ran a brothel out of the hotel in this town. And that was the original foundation of the Trump fortune.
Wow.
I learned that. Wow. But I was really disappointed by it. Maybe someone else who's listening to the podcast can weigh in. I just, that, and it, oh, I almost went downtown and saw it at the Gene Siskel Film Center. It got universally positive reviews.
Wow.
And I thought they were reviewing the phenomenon. Oh, they discovered all this film.
Right.
And clearly it's well curated, but I did not enjoy it.
The Siskel Center is bringing back The Love Witch on Valentine's Day. Did you see that?
No.
Have you watched The Love Witch yet?
No, I haven't.
What is wrong with you?
I'm waiting to see it on Valentine's Day. In fact, that could be a double feature.
They're probably going to show it on 35.
Because the Music Box always shows Casablanca on Valentine's Day.
Oh, okay.
You could Casablanca in the afternoon, Love Witch in the evening.
Somebody, maybe Mike Piccoli, said he went to see it on 35 at the Siskel Center and said the print was really bad, which is inexcusable because that movie needs to be shown perfectly.
Right.
It needs to be pristine.
Maybe they made one print. And
they must have, yeah.
Around the country.
Mm.
Also, the Chicago Film Critics screening is the night of Valentine's Day.
Right.
Say Anything.
Right.
The Elk Grove Theater.
I've got a couple I can rattle off. Is that okay?
Yeah, and I didn't mean to filibuster.
No, you're
I just
fine.
Thought all of them were of a piece.
Yeah. Are there others on your list?
No.
Okay. Then I'll go through mine pretty quick. The Fate of the Furious, which I think is a pretty bad movie and was disappointing to me as somebody who's kind of a fan of the franchise. I used to be more so.
And you were a super fan of the
franchise. Was around 5 and 6. I wasn't crazy about 7. I think this one is actively bad.
You were the only reason I finally went to see Paul Walker's last one.
7, yeah.
And you like 7.
It's okay. I'm not crazy about it.
But I remember when the new one came out.
Yeah.
What the reaction was from everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, the new one's not great. Alien Covenant, it should be better at this point. I had my hopes up.
Someone said this in the comments, and I don't mean to keep going back to the comments, but we read your comments.
That's true.
And they're hurtful. I'm not going to – no. That Alien Covenant – may have actually done something I thought impossible. It made me rethink Prometheus.
Oh, I think Prometheus is a better film.
I agree. But remember...
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a good film. I just think it's a better film.
In the history of the podcast that we've done...
Yes.
I was particularly proud of Prometheus.
Okay.
Because even if we weren't sure going into the podcast, as we discussed it crumbled into pieces in our hands.
Yeah. I think it's a better movie because I think it tries to be more. And so the fact that Alien Covenant is mostly just trying to be a monster movie and I think kind of fails on that level as well. Again, there are people who love it. There are people who think it is brilliant. I have seen it show up on top 10 lists.
And here's a new game I would like to suggest we all start playing. In actual movie theaters, whenever white translucent giants show up, we all stand up in our seats and shout, Damon Lindelof! Because Lindelof loves those white translucent giants.
Well, and
giants.
He didn't have anything to do with Covenant, and Covenant had very little patience for the white translucent giants.
But Prometheus did.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And he's had his fingers in other things.
Sure.
Where...
Atomic Blonde, I thought had an amazing trailer.
Yeah.
And looked, again, not to be too dismissive, but it looked like John Wick, but with Charlize Theron. I'm on board for that. Some decent action. She's certainly good in the part and is very physical, but goddamn, is that movie a slog.
I was excited for Atomic Blonde, like you said, the trailer. And then I waited. I waited out opening weekend. And it saved me 2 hours and $10.
Yeah. It's here's an 80s song, and here's, it's like too much boring spy shit. I don't know. Like John Wick understands why you're there.
When is a movie theater going to be honest and releases a film with the tagline, 2 hours, $10? It's copyright F this movie. The rights given
and, then two other smaller movies that I was disappointed by. One was The Bad Batch, which is a movie written and directed by Anna Lily Amirpour, who had made A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which I didn't love, but was very beautiful. And again, like, good time. I was
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And I keep coming upon The Bad Batch on the...
it's on Netflix.
I believe it's on...
It might be showing up on cable
Comcast
now, too.
VOD.
Oh, okay.
On Comcast VOD, there's a category, still in theaters.
Oh, sure.
But you know what
means. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like... three times a year, it's What's at the Music Box right now.
Well, they have to. That's why those movies get a screen, because then it can show up on VOD and on iTunes as in theaters, which makes it more appealing for people to watch it as long as it's showing on a screen.
But like I said, about three times a year, you get a 78-52, which
right.
I really wanted
right.
to see,
right, right.
but I didn't have to go out.
Right.
I think they discontinued this policy, but for about 6 months this year, Streets of Woodfield, AMC Streets of Woodfield.
It was one of the places where those would show up. Yeah.
The weirdest things would show up on one screen, two screenings a day for 3 days.
Yeah.
And every time I saw it, I would turn to my lovely wife and say, contractually obligated screening.
It's true. And it was Get the Girl, which was one of my underrated picks. Showed up for 1 week at Streets of Woodfield, one show a day.
I'm trying to think of the actress. She's in a bunch of these things that come out in that very odd way. She got an Oscar nomination. She plays a man who was like a butler or something.
Not Glenn Close.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Glenn Close is in a lot of these.
Interesting.
That show up at one theater.
I'm just excited that you made an Albert Nobbs reference.
Yes, that's the film. and I was once a fan of Glenn Close around the time of The Big Chill.
Sure. So The Bad Batch.
40 years ago.
I liked A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night was a calling card and made me want to see whatever she made next. And The Bad Batch looked bigger and more ambitious. And it had Keanu Reeves as like the king of a cannibal group. And it had Jim Carrey doing something crazy and Jason Momoa. And it had all these things. And I was like, I'm so on board for The Bad Batch. And it is not great. It was a drag. And The Assignment, which is the Walter Hill movie. Where Michelle Rodriguez, have you read about The Assignment?
I believe I have.
Michelle Rodriguez kills someone, Sigourney Weaver's brother, and Sigourney Weaver, she plays a man who's a hitman, Michelle Rodriguez, in bad male prosthetics.
I have not read about this.
It's fucking unbelievable. So why they didn't just cast a male actor, I don't know. Instead, they dress Michelle Rodriguez as a man.
Well, that's the twist.
She's an assassin. She kills someone. It's Sigourney Weaver's brother. Sigourney Weaver is very upset about this, so she turns the hitman into a woman. She performs an involuntary gender reassignment surgery, and now it's Michelle Rodriguez who wants revenge for being made a woman. And
this sounds like the greatest movie ever made.
It's, I mean, on the one hand, it's like so offensive and nightmarish, and you're like, I can't believe someone made it. And then on the other hand, you're like, well, I guess I give him credit for doing that in 2017, because what? It's an idea he had in the 70s when that would have probably been more acceptable. But goddamn, is the execution shitty, and to see Walter Hill just flail like this was... very disappointing.
So, whoever runs Redbox.
This is The Assignment is streaming somewhere as well, possibly Amazon Prime.
I'm of the opinion that Rob DiCristino actually runs Redbox.
He does. That's why he writes that column, because it puts some coin in his pocket. The Assignment was originally called Reassignment.
But that gives too much away.
And they changed it. So
all
we have.
Here's the quote for The Assignment from F This Movie.
Okay.
Offensive and nightmarish on so many levels.
It is. But then, you know, it's also trying to be super pulpy. It's frustrating. And all that we have left is the ugly.
And far be it from us to pile on. But lately, and I should be used to this because I'm old and I'm going to die soon, all of this stuff on social media where nothing is truly bad, I disagree with that. I think that things can be objectively bad. Maybe that's how I'm different from the rest of the human race. But if I were to make something like, oh, I don't know, a podcast, and someone in an objective, intelligent way were to point out in 10 different ways, perhaps, that what I have done was bad, I could then use that information to convince myself that I had failed.
Sure.
And perhaps to do a better podcast.
Absolutely.
So, again, I'm not trying to pile on, but the specific tweet was something like, there is no such thing as bad. It's just not for you. And that, I understand what's in your heart that makes you want to embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's bad things.
I mean,
objectively bad.
You know me. I've been having this debate for years.
And it keeps resurfacing on F This Movie because obviously if you're serious about this endeavor, it comes up. It is art that we're talking about, not soda pop.
Yeah, it's just hard, and this is just a different conversation because even the bad podcast that you're talking about, somebody could mount a great defense of why this is bad, right? But if for one person, if that's their favorite podcast and it brings them joy, what do you say? It's still bad? They just love something that's bad? I mean, it is, right? Because we're saying objectively it's bad, but to this person, it's not.
My knee-jerk reaction, as I await the approbation of every listener, is you're wrong to love this.
I have to call bullshit on that. I don't know. I get what you're saying, and there are things that I'm like, this is objectively bad. We're going to talk about Baywatch, right? It's to me, that's like, this is objectively bad, and I can give you a list of 50 reasons why I think this is bad. But if somebody if Baywatch was somebody's favorite movie,
and one night Baywatch kept someone from killing
Right. You know, again, I think I'm right to say it's bad, but I can't argue with fun.
Yes, and I agree with you. And again, art is subjective.
Right.
But what I'd hope is, and I think the reason for this podcast is,
yes,
if I point out to this person that they are wrong to love it,
okay,
they would be able to give me reasons that they love it beyond I love it.
I agree with that 100%.
And one thing that both of us don't like is that too many people stop at, I love this.
Right. But I also think too many people stop at, that sucks.
True.
Without any articulation. I was listening to something recently where they just were rattling off Thor Ragnarok. Oh my God, it was the worst movie. Spider-Man Homecoming. Oh, that sucked. Let's move on. I'm like, well, you can't just say stuff.
And it's endemic to our national plight in that, and I don't mean to get pretentious, but if we're talking about politics, tough, I like it, isn't enough.
Right.
It's not enough anymore.
Right. And I would argue it's not enough for art, which is why every week we spend an hour saying, we like this and here's why, or we didn't like this and here's why. Otherwise, it would be a 30-second podcast where we would make a fart noise or be quiet for 30 seconds. And that's how we show that we like it. So these are movies that I did not like.
Someone's
going
to turn that into a column. Fart or be quiet. A binary movie review.
These are movies that I really did not like. If they brought you some joy, good. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, which, again, I took my kids to see because my son reads those books. I think there's a world of difference between I'm not the audience for this and they made a thing that is shitty because, yeah, you know, my 9-year-old kid had fun, but I can look at it and be like, man, but this is not good. On any of the levels by which we judge art.
And apparently, well, first of all, what did he think of it?
he enjoyed it because they were acting out the book that he had read.
This is this book that I read. That apparently there are plenty of people who love Girls Trip.
Yeah.
So when I first brought that up, I had texted you something about it because, A, I was confusing it with
Rough Night.
And I just thought Girls Trip was obvious and offensive.
Sure.
Oh, and here's the big revelation for 2017. Sorry, I buried the lead. This is the whole point of the podcast. This year, I have prefaced so many statements with, I'm no shrinking violet, but I am a shrinking violet.
Okay.
I am now officially a shrinking violet.
Well, there goes that preface.
When someone's roped above Mardi Gras and projectile pees on the crowd, I don't think that's particularly funny.
Sure.
Especially when there's not a pinata joke in sight.
But it's not that's not being a shrinking violet, right? Isn't that just saying, like, that's not funny? You're not laughing because you're offended. You're not laughing because there's no joke.
Right. But it's like, I don't remember the stand-up comedian to credit this to, but the basic gist is, if you preface, no, that's not the joke. Here's the joke. When someone begins speak and says,
I'm not a racist, right.
But you know what's coming out
of
their
head. What they're about to say is racist.
I'm officially a shrinking violet. I never imagined this would happen given my college self.
Sure.
I am now easily offended. Girls Trip is not for me. I enjoyed the gusto of one of the performances.
Tiffany Haddish.
I wish she was given something to do that was clever.
As do I.
And she was real good on SNL.
Yeah. Yes, she was.
I went to see The Mummy.
Oof. That's on my list as well.
And
God damn.
Again, it's just given the story that they're working from, it's unfathomably bad.
Yeah.
And I may have said this before. It really gives you newfound love for Brendan Fraser, who in the Stephen Sommers Mummy plays a lovable rogue.
Mm-hmm.
In this year's The Mummy, Tom Cruise is awful.
Yes.
His character is an awful person.
Yes.
Who just fucks people over.
Correct.
And this sounds awfully familiar. I think I brought this up on a podcast. There's a Broadway musical called Carousel.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character
we talked about this.
Has to be played by a lovable rogue.
Right.
And I once saw it played by a thug.
Right.
And you're like, oh, you really? That's a real hard point to hit where he does things, but you still, oh, my God. And his buddy, who we've seen in other things.
Jake Johnson.
Is just given nothing to do, and it's this thing.
Well, he's playing Griffin Dunne in American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, pretty
exactly. It's with the exception of Sophia Boutella, who I kind of enjoyed, even though she's not given much to do, but she's an interesting presence.
And it's something we really haven't seen.
Right.
Although
Mummy 2 kind of does it.
And the Johan.
Eh? The Johan?
No, I'm sorry. It's late.
It's not late. It's like 4:30.
It's late for me.
I'm sorry.
And that I'm late now for the dinner special.
Oh, shit. That's right.
At the diner that AARP requires me to go to for apprentice Padawan.
All I was going to say was, with the exception of the casting of Sophia Boutella, I think this Mummy movie fails on every single
it does.
Level.
I'm trying to remember Zita Johan, who's the female in the Boris Karloff.
Got it.
And there's aspects of that,
yes.
Although not many. This film was made, and then it was shelved, and then it was re-edited, and then it was shelved again, and then it was re-edited. And could this be Harvey Weinstein's final film?
Oh,
the final thing
I knew this was going to show up.
And perhaps covered with another substance thumbprint on it.
Yeah.
It's called Tulip Fever. I thought it looked interesting because in the wake of the 2008 economic breakdown, everyone compared it to the tulip frenzy that everyone now uses as an analogy. It's got actors in it I like, and it's so bad.
on so many levels. I got out of the film and I tweeted, because I'm trying to be the guy who tweets. Tulip Fever is the final Shakespeare play that he wrote after the stroke. It's so obvious in every one of its minutes what it's trying to be, and failing. Most of which is Shakespeare in Love. Shakespeare in Love is the template, obviously. And again, no matter what you think of Shakespeare in Love, Tulip Fever will, Shakespeare in Love will grow in your estimation because, oh my God, it was so bad.
It's some classic, I was going to say that's it's some classic Weinstein bullshit, but that now has a different meaning when we say, oh, that's some classic Weinstein bullshit.
That it was made for a very specific audience.
And then fucked with and cynically cast and then re-edited and shelved and just, there's so many movies that they just, as much as, again, speaking completely independently of what a fucking monster he is, as much as they were, they could be a friend to filmmaking or filmmakers, they were just as much monsters when it came to that shit.
Oh, and just
burying films and
re-editing.
And yeah, so whatever. Fuck them. I have, I'll just rattle a couple off. Friend Request, which I saw with Adam Riske alone in a theater. I don't even know what to say. It's not a movie. Like, I don't know what to call it. It's not even a movie. Live by Night, the Ben Affleck adaptation of the Dennis Lane.
The Florida thing.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Oof. I didn't go.
It's showing up on HBO a lot. Boy, is it bad.
The first time I saw the trailer, I was like, maybe.
Have you seen Mobsters?
Yeah.
Mobsters is so much better. So much better.
I'd love to see that on the poster. Mobsters is so much
really,
better.
It truly is.
But it's the poster for the Affleck film.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Mobsters is better. Patrick Bromley, F this movie.
And then we talked about this, I think, on the Blade Runner show. I Love You, Daddy, the now buried Louis C.K. movie, which he has bought back from the Orchard.
Which you got to see.
Which I got to see and may see a release someday. I kind of doubt it, but who knows. It's just a real not good movie.
He'll put it on his website for $5.
Maybe. I don't know. But it's not good. And then I have two more that are the two worst movies I saw this year, but you can do some more.
Okay. I believe I saw this film with you, sir. It Comes at Night.
One of the worst of the year?
Yeah.
Interesting.
In that it seemed to me to be a long Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah.
With a very disappointing finale.
I would agree with that, but I thought the filmmaking was good enough
that
it would keep it off my worst of list.
But again, like an M. Night Shyamalan film, as well made or not as it is, when you get to the end of The Village...
Yeah.
That's what sinks it.
Sure.
And the whole thing is leading you down this primrose path to this thing that you think is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
And it was disappointing.
Yeah.
Earlier in the year, we debated whether Baywatch or Chips was worse. You maintain Baywatch is much worse than Chips.
I do.
I have not yet seen Baywatch.
No, you're fine.
I...
If for no other reason than Baywatch is 2 hours long and Chips is like 85 minutes.
You win.
Baywatch wins.
Baywatch is worse if weight, if not by volume. I hurried out because I knew it wouldn't be out long because I had to see The Snowman.
Oh, boy.
And it's not as bad as everyone was saying. It's a mess.
Okay.
And the minute you're told, well, they didn't get to finish filming all the scenes, and when you notice in the opening credits that there's two editors listed, and one of them is Schumacher.
Oh, okay.
Clearly, someone was called in to fix it.
Right.
And about 20 minutes in, it's something of a murder mystery.
Okay.
I guessed it. If you've seen five murder mysteries, it's not that hard.
Got it.
Okay, got it. And I was right. So that was. And, you know, Fassbender's in it, and he's always interesting. The Aaron Sorkin Steve Jobs film.
Yeah.
I've now seen several times on cable.
Okay.
It's on a lot. And I have problems with that film,
mm-hmm.
but Fassbender is really something to watch.
Yeah,
in
he's
that
a really,
film
he's for a really good actor.
Reasons. He's good.
He's good in Alien Covenant. He's the thing that
oh,
works,
yeah,
you know?
That
like, yeah.
I am my own grandpa.
go ahead.
And I went to see Logan Lucky.
Worst, really?
No.
Oh.
Oh, no, I, yeah.
Really?
I
could see it disappointing, but also showing up on a lot of top 10 lists, by the way. Yeah, which I was surprised by.
I was intrigued by the distribution model. They're trying to pioneer a new way of doing it. But ultimately, I will use a cooking metaphor. It's a souffle.
Yeah.
It doesn't rise.
Right.
All the elements are there.
Right.
But and it ultimately looks like it was a lot more fun to make
sure.
than it is to watch. Now, you saw it.
I right? did.
It's...
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
No, I agree. And I like a lot of the people in it, and I love Steven Soderbergh, and I was rooting for it.
Everyone's in a different movie.
Yeah.
And there's a problem with tone.
Sure. It's, you know, he seems to be kind of trying to capture Ocean's 11.
Right. And you said disappointing, so
yeah.
I think that's...
Yeah.
That I really had high hopes for that one.
Given who's involved, I wanted to like it a lot more.
That cardboard stand-up was in the one hallway of AMC South Barrington forever with the tantalizing... You know, sometimes they have the actual date at
yeah.
the bottom of the
yeah,
poster.
Yeah, yeah.
This one said August, so they're teasing us with the month.
I wonder if it was not Steven Soderbergh and not Steven Soderbergh returning to directing after sort of famously claiming he was retiring... If it would be showing up on so many top 10 lists, I think sometimes there's a little bit of a tendency for film writers and critics to champion their people. And if a different filmmaker's name was attached to this, would they be so quick to say this is one of the best movies of the year?
And everyone in it seems to be having fun.
Yeah. I like Channing Tatum. The two worst movies I saw this year, we've already talked about. Baywatch, I think, is the worst movie I saw this year. A movie that is bad in every conceivable way.
A film that had an enormous cardboard stand-up
yeah.
in many, many theaters.
Yeah, yeah. And the other is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. And
I did not see.
Which you're fine. Again, it's...
Wait, was that directed by...
Guy Ritchie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who, say no more.
Again, keeps being handed...
Does King Arthur box in this
big,
one?
Big, expensive movies. Of course he does.
You're kidding.
100%
he bought.
I swear to God. I swear to God.
Well, he was known as the Boxing King. Forget about the Round Table and the Holy Grail. He was the Boxing King.
It is the movie that we should put in a vault and say, here's what's wrong with blockbuster filmmaking in 2017.
Boxing Day in England, the day after Christmas? That's King Arthur. That's... Did you?
And this is something that I keep...
I learned that in the movie The Darkest Hour.
This is something that I keep pointing out, and this is a conversation that we've been having because we keep seeing so few women being given an opportunity to direct. You know, we get Kathryn Bigelow makes a movie every few years, and now, hey, Patty Jenkins made Wonder Woman, so we're good, right? Obama's president, and now we're good. It doesn't work that way. Now we have to keep giving them opportunities. Guy Ritchie just keeps being handed... fucking big movies. He's doing Aladdin for Disney. Can you think of a worse person to be handed a children's film? Not that I'm interested in a live action Aladdin starring Will Smith as the genie. Like, none of this on paper interests me, but Guy Ritchie being in charge of this after seeing King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, goddamn, is that a bad idea?
And maybe it's because it's so difficult for women to get directing jobs. And I'm sure we'll talk about this more next week. I'm not the biggest fan of Greta Gerwig as an actress.
Sure.
But when I think back at Lady Bird,
yeah,
that movie is extraordinary, if only for the pitfalls and cliches of the coming-of-age story
yeah.
that it avoids.
Yeah. Yeah.
If and there's other reasons to love it, too.
Right.
So... I like women. Oh, I'm just going to say it.
Sure.
I don't think I've ever said it on
the
podcast.
This is the year where you're going to take a hard line here.
I like women.
Yeah.
And I like the Tin Man.
I saw fewer movies that I outright loathed this year because I think I avoided a lot of stuff, honestly. So making my sort of ugly list was like, I only saw a handful of stuff that I would include on this list. Because, you know, my disappointing list, it's like there were moments, there were scenes, there were things about it that I'm like, yeah, I liked this, but these movies on the ugly list, there's essentially nothing redeeming about them.
I find a good rule of thumb is, because I usually go to movies with my lovely wife, Jan, and after the show, we'll talk about the movie, mm-hmm. sometimes at length. There's movies where there's nothing to talk about.
Right.
And you drive home in silence, and it's just soul-crushing.
That used to happen every once in a while because before kids, we would go see a couple movies at a time. And there would be some movies where it was so bad that it ruined your mood to go see something else. So we would just leave. Like, oh, we had planned to see two more movies, but I don't want to sit through anything else because that was so bad.
I'm so sad. I lack the motivation to jump the ropes and cheat this theater out of another admission price.
I refuse to not pay for another movie. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. This is always a really fun show to do. And, of course, next week, one of my favorite shows to do, our Best of the Year podcast.
The top 10, the toppermost of the poppermost.
Between then and now, JB will be traveling to Los Angeles. He's going to come back a different person. He's just going to be talking about
assignment?
Entourage. Oh,
is
yes.
Because of the assignment?
Also, and the assignment. But we both have movies to watch, which is fun because we can watch stuff off of each other's lists. So that's cool. And next week, we're going to talk about some of our favorite movies of the year. Thank you again, JB.
You're welcome.
And we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.